The Hidden Life of Trees, Chapter 32, Immigrants. Thanks to the migration of trees, the forest is constantly changing. And not just the forest, all of nature. And that's why many human attempts to conserve particular landscapes fail. What we see is always a brief snapshot of a landscape that only seems to be standing still. The illusion is almost perfect in the forest, because trees are among the slowest moving beings with which we share our world, and changes in the natural forest are observable only over the course of many human generations. One of these changes is the arrival of new species. Thanks to the botanical souvenirs early plant hunters brought back to their homelands, and more recent arrivals because of the forestry industry, a huge number of tree species have been introduced that would have never found their way to Europe on their own. Names like Douglas fir, Japanese larch, and grand fir don't occur in European folk songs or poems because they've not yet become fixtures in Europe's shared social memory. The process works in the other direction as well. European arrivals make their own mark when travellers in search of a new life bring memories of home along in their luggage. Immigrants have a special status in the forest. In contrast to tree species that have migrated naturally, they arrive without their typical ecosystems. In some cases, just their seeds were imported, which means that most of the fungi and all of the insects remained back in their homelands. Douglas fir and co. could make a completely new start in Europe. That can certainly have its advantages. There are absolutely no illnesses because of pests, at least not in the first decades. People had a similar experience in Antarctica. The air there is almost completely devoid of germs or dust, which would be ideal for people with allergies, if only the continent were not so isolated. When trees hop over to a new continent with our help, it's like a big breath of fresh air for them. The lucky ones find fungal partners for their roots among the non-specialists. Beaming with health, the new arrivals grow mighty trunks in European forests, and they do so in very short periods of time. No wonder they seem superior to the native species, at least in some locations. Trees that migrate under their own steam can establish themselves only where they feel completely at home. Not only the climate, but also the type of soil and moisture levels must fit their lifestyles if they're going to prevail in the presence of the old trees that already rule the forest. For trees that we humans introduce into the forest, the long-term outcome is a bit like a game of roulette. You never know exactly what's going to happen. The black cherry, for example, is a deciduous tree from North America that has a wonderfully beautiful trunk and high-quality wood when it grows there. No question, European foresters wanted to have a tree like that in their forests. But after a few decades, disillusionment set in. In their new land, the trees grew crooked and lopsided and hardly got taller than 65 feet, and they barely grew at all under the pines of eastern and northern Germany. The trees fell out of favour, but by now people couldn't get rid of them. Deer spurned their bitter branches, preferring to nibble away at beeches, oaks, or, if absolutely necessary, even pines. And so the black cherry got the burdensome arboreal competition off its back, and the newcomer keeps expanding its territory. The Douglas fir can also tell you a tale or two about the uncertainty of the future. In some places, after growing for more than 100 years, they have become impressive giants. Other forests, however, have had to be cut down in their entirety before they matured, as I experienced firsthand in my intern year in forestry school. A small forest of Douglas firs, barely 40 years old, was beginning to die. Scientists puzzled over this for a long time. Whatever could have caused this decline? It wasn't fungi, and insects were ruled out as well. The culprit finally turned out to be an excess of manganese in the soil, which, apparently, the Douglas firs couldn't tolerate. It also turns out there is no such thing as the Douglas fir, as separate varieties with completely different characteristics were imported to Europe. Those from the Pacific coast are the best fit. Their seeds, however, got mixed with seeds from inland species that grow a long way from the ocean. And to complicate the situation further, both crossbreed easily, producing offspring, all of which express characteristics that are completely unpredictable. Unfortunately, it often takes at least 40 years before you can tell whether the trees are healthy or not. If they are, they keep their vivid blue-green needles and thick crowns with tightly packed branches. The trunks of hybrids that contain too many genes from inland trees begin to bleed resin and their needles look distressed. In the end, this is simply a natural correction, albeit a cruel one. Genetic misfits are discarded, even if the process plays out over many decades. Our native beaches have had no trouble showing these interlopers the door. They employ the same strategy they use in their competition with oaks. The deciding factor that has allowed beeches to win out over Douglas firs over the course of centuries is their ability to grow in the deepest, darkest shade under large trees. The offspring of the North American mothers need much more light and perish in the kindergartens established by our native deciduous trees. It is only when people lend a helping hand by repeatedly clearing trees so that sunlight reaches the ground that the little Douglas firs stand a chance. It's dangerous when foreigners pop up that are genetically very similar to native species. The Japanese larch is just such a case. When it arrived here, it met the European larch. The European larch often grows crooked and, in addition, quite slowly. And so in the last century, it was often replaced with the Japanese tree. Both species cross easily to form hybrids. This raises the danger that one day, a long time from now, the last purebred European larches will disappear. There's just such a mixing and muddling of genes going on in the forest I manage in the Eifel Mountains, where neither species is native. Another candidate for extinction is the black poplar, which mixes with cultivated hybrid poplars that have been crossed with Canadian poplars. But most introduced species pose no threat to native trees. Without our help, a number of them would have disappeared again after a couple of hundred years at the most. Even with our help, the survival of the new arrivals is questionable in the long term, for the pests that plague them take advantage of global trade. It is true that there is no active import of these organisms. After all, who would want to introduce damaging pests? Yet, slowly but surely, fungi and insects are making their way across the Atlantic or the Pacific in imported lumber and establishing themselves in Europe. Often, they come in packing materials, such as wood pallets that haven't been heated to sufficiently high temperatures to kill harmful organisms. And parcels sent by private individuals from overseas sometimes contain living insects. I have personal experience of this. I had an antique moccasin from North America shipped to my home in Germany. As I unpacked the leather footwear from its newspaper wrapping, a number of small brown beetles crawled in my direction. I caught them as quickly as I could, squished them, and disposed of them in the trash. Squishing bugs might sound odd coming from the pen of a conservationist, but introduced insects, once they get established, are life-threatening, not only for the introduced species, but also for natives. The Asian longhorn beetle poses just such a threat. It probably travelled to Europe and other parts of the world from China in packing crates. The beetle is an inch long and has 2-inch long antennae. To us, it's a beautiful-looking beetle. Its dark body is flecked with white, and it has black and white bands on its legs and antennae. Deciduous trees, however, find it decidedly less attractive, because it lays its eggs individually in numerous small splits in their bark. Voracious larvae hatch and feed, and adult beetles drill thumb-sized exit holes in the trunk. These holes are then attacked by fungi, and eventually the trunk breaks. In Europe, the beetles are still concentrated in urban areas, making life even more difficult for the street kids. We don't yet know if they will spread to forested areas away from urban settlements, because the beetles are lazy and prefer to stay within a radius of a few hundred yards of the place where they were born. Another import from Asia behaves very differently. This particular fungus, ash dieback fungus, is well on its way to finishing off most of the ash trees in Europe. Its fruiting bodies look harmless, even rather cute. They are just teeny-weeny mushrooms that grow on the stalks of fallen leaves. The fungal filaments themselves, however, run amok in the trees and kill one ash after the other. A few ash trees seem to survive the repeated assaults, but it is questionable whether there will be ash forests lining the banks of European streams and rivers in the future. In connection with this, I sometimes wonder if foresters don't play a role in the spread of the disease. I visited damaged forests in southern Germany, and then afterward, I was out and about in the forest I manage, wearing the same shoes. Might there have been tiny fungal spores on my soles that travelled into the Eiffel Mountains as stowaways? Whatever the case may be, since then, the first ash trees in Hummel have also been struck with the disease. Despite all this, I'm not anxious when I think about the future of our forests. For on large continents, and the Eurasian continent is the largest one of all, species have to come to grips with the new arrivals all the time. Migrating birds bring small animals, fungal spores, or the seeds of new species of trees tucked in their feathers, or these organisms are blown in by turbulent storms. A 500-year-old tree has surely had a few surprises in its life. And thanks to the great genetic diversity in a single species of tree, there is always a sufficient number of individuals that can rise to a new challenge. If you live in or have travelled to Germany, you might well have already noticed some of the new naturalised avian citizens that have turned up without any help from people. Perhaps the Eurasian collared dove, which arrived in Germany from the Mediterranean in the 1930s. Then there is the fieldfare, a type of thrush. This grey-brown bird with dark speckles has been migrating westward for 200 years. It started in the northeast and has now reached France. We don't know yet what surprises these birds might have brought with them in their feathers. A decisive factor in how robust native forests are in the face of such changes is how unspoiled they are. The more intact the social connections and the more moderated the microclimate under the trees, the more difficult it is for foreign invaders to get established. Plants that make headlines are classic examples of this. Take giant hogweed, also known as wild parsnip or wild rhubarb. It originally came from the Caucasus and grows more than 10 feet tall. The white flower heads can measure up to 18 inches across, and because they're so pretty, the plant was imported into Central Europe and elsewhere in the 19th century. The plants escaped out of the gardens where they were planted and since then have been spreading across the countryside with ease. Giant hogweed is considered extremely dangerous because its sap, in combination with ultraviolet light, can burn human skin. Every year, millions are spent digging up plants and destroying them without any great success. However, hogweed can spread only because the original forested meadows along the banks of rivers and streams no longer exist. If these forests were to return, it would be so dark under the forest canopy that hogweed would disappear. The same goes for Himalayan balsam and Japanese knotwood, which also grow on the river banks in the absence of the forests. Trees could solve the problem if people trying to improve things would only allow them to take over. I have written so much about non-native species that this might be the place to address the question of what the term native means. We tend to call species native if they occur naturally within a country's borders. A classic example from the animal world is the wolf, which reappeared in most countries in Central Europe in the 1990s, and since then has been considered a permanent part of the fauna. It was found in Italy, France, and Poland much earlier than that. This means that the wolf has been native to Europe for a long time, just not in each individual country. But isn't even this geographic unit too broad? When we talk about porpoises being native to Germany, does that mean they also make their home in the upper reaches of the Rhine? As you can see, that definition wouldn't make any sense. native must be understood on a much smaller scale and be based not on human borders, but on habitats. Habitats are defined by their features, water, terrain, topography, and by the local climate. After the last ice age, trees moved into habitats where they found conditions that suited them. That means, for example, that spruce occur naturally, and therefore can be considered native, at an elevation of 4,000 feet in the Bavarian forest. But they do not occur naturally, and therefore cannot be considered native, 1,300 feet lower and only half a mile away, where beeches and firs hold sway. Specialists have come up with the term habitat-specific, which simply means each species has habitats where they are happy to grow. In contrast to our large-scale country borders, habitat borders for species are like a proliferation of small states. When people ignore these boundaries and bring spruce and pines down to warmer elevations, these conifers are not natives in this new location. They are immigrants. And with that, we have arrived at my favourite example, redwood ants. In Europe, redwood ants are icons of nature conservation. In many locations, they are mapped, protected, and in cases of conflict, resettled. There can be no objection to this because what we are talking about here is a threatened species. Threatened? And yet, redwood ants are immigrants too, and therefore, I would argue that no special efforts are necessary for their protection. They travel on the coattails of commercially grown spruce and pines. You could say they hang on to the needles for dear life, for without the conifers' spiny, narrow needles, they can't build their anthills. And this proves that they were not present in the original native deciduous forests. Moreover, they love the sun, and they need it to shine on their nests for at least a few hours a day. Especially in spring and fall, when it is bitterly cold, a few warm rays ensure additional days when the ants can rummage around. Dark beech woods are, therefore, ruled out as a habitat, and redwood ants are forever thankful to foresters for planting huge expanses of spruce and pines.